This is the podcast for Wednesday, November 30th, 2011, ethics. And to answer that question, the testing lab closes next Thursday, not tomorrow, but next Thursday, December 8th at 5 o'clock, which means the very, very, very latest you can get there is 4 o'clock next Thursday, not the Thursday after next, December 8th. And the finals open early, so you can take it today, Thursday, Friday, lab closes at 5, all the way up till Thursday at 5 o'clock. Friday, the lab is closed. So don't show up Friday expecting to take it Friday morning or Friday afternoon. The lab is closed, and you'll be like sending a panic email or a phone call to me or something. So I like to avoid that. So everybody, what day does the lab close?
Thursday.
5 o'clock. So it's, you know, so get there by 4, and of course, you know, any time before that is good. And I think they open at 8, so they're open a little earlier. So if you're an early bird, you can get there early as well. So they're on the sheet here, but it's 8 to 8 and 8 to 5. 8 to 8 Monday through Wednesday. 8 to 5. On Thursday, and the hours this week are just normal hours, which I think is 9 to 7, except for Friday they close at 5. And there's a link in Moodle that says Computer Testing Lab that you can look at home, and if you can't remember. Okay. Any last comments or questions about? Maybe I'll just start at the beginning, and then we can take these any questions on the moral and political knowledge last. Go back to the early stuff. So deontology. Oh, just a couple things to prepare for the exam. So, what will be on the exam? Terms like deontology. Terms like, like distinctions between things like positive and negative duties. Funny Greek words like arete, eudaimonia, and these are all in the study guide. Understanding who had what view. You need to know that Kant, deontology, Aristotle, virtue ethics. Particular examples. Like we talked about, what's Kant say about a person? What does Kant say about a person who seems to be sincerely think that it's okay to do X where X seems obviously wrong? What would Kant say? And we'll go through some of these particular things. So terms, philosophers, views, and then the pro and con arguments and examples. And that pretty much runs the gamut of the things that we cover here. And also I'm available for individual help during my office hours, and also during other times during final exam week, and this week. So just contact me if you can't make my office hours, and we can set something up. And you online students, or even students of the class, if you want to set up a phone appointment, I can talk to you on the phone as well if in person doesn't work because you're a busy working person or have a hectic schedule or kids or whatever. So I'm here to help. Okay, deontology. What is deontology? Deontology is the view that there are certain absolute rights and responsibilities that apply to everyone. So the word deon comes from the term rule, and so deontology says that the right act is the one which is in accord with the correct moral rule or principle. Derived from reason. But it has to do with following absolute rules and principles, which have no exceptions. And so to figure out what the right act is, you have to figure out what the relevant principle is, and then hold to that principle absolutely and don't deviate from it. What is the only thing which is intrinsically good according to Kant? Anybody? A goodwill, right? A goodwill. Think Christmas time.
You have the first page?
Three?
Yeah.
Three first pages?
Yeah.
Okay.
last week.
Oh yeah, I noticed an uneven thing here. Maybe I'll see one of the pages.
I thought there was only one page.
Oh, there's two pages.
Which one do you need?
Why are there? I printed that. Did some people take two of one page because? keep on sending them around. So who hasn't gotten the back page that says virtue ethics in the back? Here's an ethical principle. When handouts float around, don't just like set them down next to your desk in the back, but keep them moving along. Pay attention. I can. So just check for their hours. Their hours, they're open a little later sometimes, I think. They'll tell you what the lab hours are. It's hard to keep track of those, so I'm not sure what they are. So you check with them. Okay. Six pages.
I have a lot more work. Staple them together.
Okay. Everyone have two pages which are different? Okay, good.
Like, you know.
Okay, get out my ABC blocks.
One of these things is not like the other.
Okay, so where was I? What's good without qualification? A good will. So the only thing which is intrinsically good is a good will. What importance, if any, does Kant attach to the consequences of an act when evaluating whether it is right or wrong?
None whatsoever.
Exactly. None whatsoever. Kant says the consequences are completely irrelevant. How important is motive for Kant in assessing the rightness or wrongness of an act? Motive is everything. Motive is the only thing that matters. Now, Kant has a funny way of defining motive and acting with a good will such that it's not enough to feel like you're doing the right thing. You have to think about it and make a rational decision. But he says that your reason for doing it, the principle that you're acting on, is the only thing that matters. Your motive is everything. Does Kant accept hedonism? No, right? What is hedonism?
Maximize pleasure.
Close. That's utilitarianism. Yeah. Yeah, hedonism says the only thing which is intrinsically valuable is happiness. And so you put that together with consequentialism and you get maximized happiness, which is the utilitarian view. But Kant completely rejects hedonism. And he uses this example. He says, well, what about evil people? You don't want them to be happy, right? You don't want like that guy that's, raping the ball boy or whatever to really enjoy it, right? You want him to suffer. You want him to be punished. And so the idea that happiness is always good, Kant says, is ridiculous. Does he accept consequentialism? And apologies for those of you who don't follow the news or sports or anything. I don't follow sports, but I do follow the news. But there's been coaches who have been sexually assaulting young boys years ago, and it's finally come to light, and it's all over the news. So, again, a person who is perpetrating an evil act, Kant says, the pleasure that a person derives from that is bad. And so, whereas a utilitarian would say, well, the act is wrong because it's creating more unhappiness than happiness, but the happiness that the person, that the evildoer gets is still good, which is kind of counterintuitive. Where do deontological rules come from, according to Kant? What do you think he would say?
Pure reason.
Pure reason, right? You just have to think about them. You use your mind. You can ascertain what the correct moral rule or principle is. What are the two basic motives a person can have for performing an act? This is just kind of stilted language, I guess. Performing any action or doing something. Yeah.
Desire
and reason, right? And so desire comes in two types. Right, there's and Kant used the word inclination for it. So what are the two types of desire? Direct and indirect, right? And so the shopkeeper gives example of all three of these motives, the two kinds of desire and reason. Yeah.
In your text, in your lectures, on your
they talk about the
reason,
it's
duty.
Duty,
yeah. So
which one is actually the one you're looking at?
Right.
So on the test, I'm going to try to remember if I'll have either or maybe I'll have both. Duty or reason. So a motive, I'm going to put this, reason, direct, inclination, and indirect inclination. And both of these are desire. So the two basic ones are desire and reason. Desires have two kinds, direct and indirect, also known as direct and indirect inclination. And then your duty is coming from reason. So if you're acting from reason, you're acting according to the motive of duty. If you're acting from duty, you're acting from reason. So Kant sees these as sort of different ways of describing the same thing. Okay, so and so with the shopkeeper who always gives the right change and doesn't, you know, shortchange his customers and deals honestly with them. So he, if he just does it because he's a nice guy or because he's naturally honest, that's direct inclination. He's being honest because he likes being honest. That's the kind of guy he is. He's a nice guy. And Kant says, if that's his only motive, he doesn't get any credit for it. Because he's just doing what he wants to do. He likes being nice. If he liked being mean or dishonest or cheating people, he'd be doing that. And so Kant thinks that feelings or your natural dispositions aren't really a reliable guide for morality because you don't have any control over them. Yeah.
Do people often need credit to feel ethical or moral?
I mean, Kant's not really concerned about whether you feel ethical or moral when you do it. He's just talking about like what act counts as moral, as opposed to just non-moral. And so he says you're only performing a properly moral act if you're conscious to some degree of the motive. And so he says here are the motives that you might have for being honest. One, you like being honest. If you're honest just because you like being honest, you don't deserve any credit for it. That's not even a moral action for you. You're just like acting out of habit. And for Kant, that's a non-moral action. It's not morally good or morally bad. It's kind of, it's like, you know, is it moral for me to, you know, scratch my ear, right? Well, no, it's not. It's neither moral nor immoral. It's just my ear scratches and I scratch it because it itches and that's it. And so that's, Kant would say that it doesn't count as far as morality goes. Now he says you get another one, the next motive is indirect inclination. And that's where you don't really like being honest, but you like the things that come with honesty, like not going to jail and not having people, you know, pick at your store and so on, because you're worried about getting caught. So it's not like you don't really, really want to take people's money and to please them to take them for all they're worth. It's just that as it happens, you're worried about what will happen, what the consequences will be. And Kant says that more obviously is something that doesn't count from a moral point of view. And then finally, there's duty or reason, which is you say, I'm honest because it's the right thing to do. And Kant says, okay, then you've done something moral because you're conscious of the motive. You're acting from duty. You're saying, I'll never cheat a customer because that would be wrong. Or I'm an honest person because that's the right thing to do. And now Kant, in one aspect, he's not a kind of a fanatic about this. He says, in this one area, he says, well, and if you enjoy being honest in addition to acting honestly because it's the right thing to do, then that's okay. So it's okay to have mixed motives. It's just that habit or indirect inclination, it can't be your main motive. Your main motive has to be duty. And then if you have some other motives mixed in, like you're an honest person or you like the fact that you know that you've never had trouble with customers or boycotts or you know, police investigations. That's kind of icing on the cake. Suppose a philanthropist gives because of his love and compassion for his fellow human beings. How much moral worth do his actions bring to Kant have? A little? A lot? None whatsoever. No credit for you. What does Kant say about actions with mixed motives? I just covered that. So, as long as duty is your main motive, it's okay to have other motives mixed in. So it still has moral worth, as long as duty is still your main motive. What does Kant believe the relationship between morality, between rationality and morality is? And Kant thinks that if you're acting from, if you're acting rationally, you're acting morally. And so he thinks that, that rationality and moral, morality go together. What would Kant say about a conscientious Middle Eastern terrorist who seems sincere but mistaken about what his moral duty is? And so Kant would say that if someone thinks it's sincerely think it's okay to like kill thousands of people for a political cause, that person is either got carried away with their desires, or they're just crazy. They're like irrational. So either they're letting their desire kind of take over their reason, and they're so filled with hatred and resentment towards the West that they say, "Oh, I'm going to pay back those, you know, those evil people, those evil crusaders by you know, blowing a bunch of them up." Then that's a case where your desires are clouding your reason, or you just might be sort of like a lunatic, like a psychopath, and you're. You think it's okay to kill people.
Does he also fail one of the tests if everyone were to blow themselves up for a reason, one reason or another, it would be a bad place?
That, I mean, that's it's true that he would, I mean, it does fail the test, but and the fact that he doesn't notice that, you know, is shows that he's irrational. You know, or that And I suppose having your desire, I mean, having your reason clouded by your desires is also another case of being irrational. But, you know, there's two ways you can be irrational. You can just be kind of like Looney Tunes, and then you can be like kind of, you know, acting in a rash fashion. Like, well, like, for example, irrational behavior. Like, I observed a student coming up to an instructor and loudly accusing her and ranting and raving about a zero he got an assignment because he was accused of plagiarism, you know, in front of the whole class, or right after, you know, as class was ending. And I was thinking to myself, that's an irrational act. Why? Because, you know, that instructor is not going to take an objective evaluation of the student as he's like angrily shouting in the middle of class, and she's trying to calm him down and trying to get him not to freak out and cause a scene. So now if he was thinking purely rationally, he would think, oh, and suppose that he had plagiarized, he would think, oh, you know, she made a mistake on my assignment. I'll go to her office hours and talk to her about this one human being to another, and I'll lay out my case and hope for the best. That would be the rational thing to do. But just to go off and sort of start yelling at somebody in the middle in front of a class, it's not only kind of, you know, disrespect the other person, but it ruins your own case too. Like he's shooting himself in the foot, so to speak. So Kant would say there's lots of cases like that. And when you're acting immorally, typically what happens is you have some selfish desire, whether it's desire for revenge or a desire to have something that you can't get through honest means. And it's something that clouds your reason and makes you follow a selfish mode instead of doing what's right. Another example. It's a woman from Morocco in my Religion of the Middle East class. And I was talking in the previous class about how Islam teaches that alcoholic beverages are immoral. And it says right in the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, you're not supposed to drink alcohol. It's one of the observances that Muslims follow. And she said, you know, in where I was from, there's a liquor store in every corner, and everybody's a Muslim. What's up with that? I said, well, you know, people, and I'm like, well, do people recognize that it's forbidden? Yes, but they do it anyway. Yes, okay, well, it's, you know, human nature. And Kant would say, you know, if alcohol, drinking alcohol is immoral, it's the fact that people get carried away with their desire to drink and they ignore their moral duty.
I don't know what Kant's view was on drinking.
I don't know if he was a teetotaler or not, but I imagine that Kant would frown on a person who drank too much.
In what sense does Kant accept psychological egoism?
So, Kant accepts psychological egoism as far as desire is concerned. So, Kant says all desire is selfish. But you don't always act in a desire. Sometimes you act from reason or from duty. So all desires are selfish, but sometimes you don't act from desire. For example, it's Mother's Day, and on Mother's Day, you think it's your duty to call your mother, but you really don't want to call your mother. She just like nags you about, you know, why didn't you become a lawyer and look at your brother and what he's doing and so on. And she's just kind of like this person who's really unpleasant to talk to. But you call her up anyway and talk to her. Why? Because you think it's your duty. And Kant would say, there are things like this all the time that you really don't want to do. You kind of push down those pesky desires and say, even though this is really unpleasant and I don't want to do it, I'm going to do it. Why? Because I have to. Because she's my mother. Because that's my duty. And so the desires are what tell you what you want to do, but your duty tells you what you should do. And usually those are completely opposite things. Let's see. So that answers the second question. How can he consistently accept psychological egoism and reject ethical egoism? And it's just because you're not always acting on desires. You can act from pure reason. When you're doing your duty, you're acting from pure reason. What is an imperative? An imperative is a command you give yourself. So the imperative form in English is the one that's like, usually there's an exclamation point. Click it or tick it, right? I can give some command that you give. Study for your finals, or pay your bill by December 1st, or you'll lose all your classes. Right? So, it is a good reminder. So tomorrow, I sent out a thing on Moodle. But for those of you that don't get the emails, pay your fall bill, or you're going to lose your classes. That class that you like sniped at 7:02 on registration day is going to go away, and you're going to go to the back of the queue again. So. Words of the wise. So make sure you have your fall bill paid by tomorrow, 11:59. So it's a command you give yourself. So Kant thinks for every act, there's some sort of principle you're acting on. So and he says there's two kinds. There's hypothetical and categorical imperatives. So hypothetical imperatives tell you what you have to do to get what you want. So. Yeah. So if I say pay your bill, you know, if you want to keep your classes for fall, pay your bill. Well, suppose you're not registered for winter class. Suppose you're not registered for winter, or suppose you just like signed up for some classes you really don't care about, or suppose that you owe the college a lot of money, and you don't want to pay because you got the other uses for that money, or whatever. Right? It might not apply to you. And so it's not going to apply to you across the board. It's going to apply for you if you were part of advanced registration, if you have classes that you care about keeping, and you have the money to pay your bill. So those three things. And so it's a hypothetical imperative. Now, it would be like a categorical imperative. If you borrow money for a friend, you should pay it back. Now there, even though it's got an if there, you probably say like pay your bills, right? Pay your bills means like that you should eventually pay off people you owe, and pay your bills would be a categorical imperative because it's wrong to borrow money and not pay it back. Other categorical imperatives, don't kill innocent people.
Don't molest ball boys if you're a coach, you know, and so on and so forth. And so it's not like, oh, don't have sex with 9-year-old boys in the shower if you don't want to get fired. It's don't do it at all, right? So there's no, it's not a hypothetical imperative. In utilitarianism, it treats morality like this. Like, if you want to keep your job, then don't molest little boys. And it's like, and a lot of people look at utilitarianism like that, and they're like, well, that's, yeah, that doesn't seem really like a moral view. That's just pragmatism. And Kant would say, no, moral commandments, they apply across the board, no matter what. Molesting children is always wrong, so it's like, there's a categorical imperative, don't molest children. Don't kill innocent people. Don't take stuff that's not yours. And you kind of go down like the Ten Commandments. That's the way Kant thinks about morality. It's made up of these categorical imperatives. And you can't like make excuses or exceptions, because once you start doing that, you think, well, but you know, if, you know, suppose like, you take the case of the coach that, so there's like this sort of complicated story. So this one guy like was caught raping boys in the shower, and then the other guy didn't report him. Right? Well, he might be thinking to himself, well, yeah, it's really bad that this happened, but this coach is a great coach, and he's, you know, we're winning our games, and when we were in games, I do really well, and everybody's happy, and maybe I'll just kind of, you know, I'll tell somebody about it, but I'm not going to sort of push the issue. Why? Because it might be really bad. If this got out, it might be bad for the school's reputation. We might lose, we'll lose our coach in the middle of the season. We'll start losing games. It'll be bad for everyone. And Kant says, to sacrifice like one person, an innocent person who's being assaulted, you know, for the sake of a football game, that's where you end up with if you're a utilitarian. That's what you end up with if you're a utilitarian. So only categorical imperatives make up morality. So there's this question, which make up morality? Hypothetical, categorical, both, or neither? Only categorical imperatives. Hypothetical imperatives are non-moral. It's like, you know, if you want to quench your thirst, you know, have a glass of water, or it's something like, you know, if you want to move to a low-cost retirement area with a great climate, move to Costa Rica or something like that. Now, if you're like 20 years old, retirement's way far off. Doesn't apply to you. Don't kill innocent people. That's categorical imperative. That's morality. That does apply to you, even if you really, really want to do it. What is a maxim? So a maxim is just a moral principle. It's a moral principle. So every act has a moral principle under sort of that it represents. So a maxim is some kind of a principle of action, such that, you know, in these circumstances, here's what I'm going to do. What are Kant's two formulations of the categorical imperative, which allow us to test the morality of certain acts? So, the categorical imperative is just an expression of the moral law, and it's the thing which justifies all the individual categorical imperatives. So Kant says, you look at individual categorical imperatives like don't steal, and don't murder, and don't lie, and all those are just all those are justified by the categorical imperative, which can be formulated in a couple of different ways. It's the absolute morality formulated in a sentence. And so the first of these is the universal law formulation, and that's act only on a principle you could will to be a universal moral law. So only act only on a principle you could will to be a universal moral law. Should I write that up here? To the text. I might not have it exactly. Act. It's pinned to the tragedy and cons. Act only on a principle
or you could put max in, pretty much the same thing. You could will to be a universal moral law. So, and this is really trying to ask you, you know, could you imagine a world where everyone does it? Could you imagine a world where everyone does it? And if you can't imagine a world where everyone does it, he says that leads to what's called a contradiction in concept. And that shows that you that it's immoral. That that's not a valid moral principle. So Kant says, if you want, say you're deeply in debt and you want to like borrow money from your best friend to pay off your creditors because they're going to break your knee taps or bury you out in the Nevada desert or something, and so you tell your friend you have an inheritance coming and you just need the money for a week, and then once he gives you the money, you pay off your creditors and you head for Costa Rica. Right? So that, and Kant says, well, think about this. What could you imagine a world where everyone did that sort of thing? And so he formulates the maxim something like, when I'm in trouble, I'll lie to get money to get out of it. And he says that if everyone, you know, lied to get money, then you wouldn't be able to do what you're doing because nobody would take anybody's word anymore. You'd live in a world of liars and schemers, and everybody would ask for collateral, and you wouldn't be able to get your loan. So if because morality is universal, you ought to be able to imagine a world where everyone does it. If you can't, that shows that your principle is immoral. So this has to do with this idea that morality, whatever morality is, we know that morality is universal. It's the same for everyone. You know, it's like, I think of an example. You're standing in line in the cafeteria, right? And somebody like cuts in front of line in front of you, and you say, what's the deal? And they say, well, I don't have to stand in line. The rules are different for me than they are for you, right? There's something funny about that, right? You think, well, if there's a line in the cafeteria and all these people want their food and they all can't get their food at the same time, you form a line. It's like first come, first served. And somebody says, well, the rules don't apply to me. He doesn't really understand the concept of a rule. So the idea that morality is universal, Kant thinks is really important, and that's like a basic fact about morality. So if you can't imagine a world where everyone does it, that shows you the principle is that the principle is invalid. And so that's called a contradiction in concept. Because you want to be able to act one way, but you want the world to act another way. And so you're not acting on a universal principle.
Wait, so that's the second?
That's the first formulation,
okay.
The universal law formulation.
Right.
And that's the one, and this expresses the intuition that moral principles should apply to everyone equally. And then the next one, the humanity formula.
So this is the universal law formulation. Then the next one is the humanity formulation. And this is the one that says, treat people always as ends in themselves, never merely as means. So the humanity formulation is the one that says you shouldn't use people. So treat people as ends, not merely as means. And that's the idea, you can't use people, you can't treat a person like an inanimate object.
Let's see, where are we at? The false promise. So the false promise I just talked about, that leads to a contradiction in concept. The rugged individualist. So the rugged individualist
leads to what Kant calls a contradiction in will. The rugged individualist. Thank you. contradiction in will. So, and this is the contradiction concept. This example is the false promise that we just talked about. Trying to get money out of your friend to pay off your bookie
or the mob or whoever you borrow the money for. That is a lot less easy to placate than your friend.
So, so the rugged individualist, the idea is that if you have the moral principle that when I have nothing to gain, I will not help others.
What kind of is that a valid moral principle?
So if you run it through, could you imagine a world where everyone did it? So you try the first part of the universal law test. Could you imagine a world where everyone did it? And you could, right? You might say, well, that's the way the world is now. But you could imagine a world where nobody helped anyone else out of the goodness of their heart or out of compassion. They just, you know, they wanted money for help, or they wanted some kind of reward. But Kant says you'd be irrational to want to live in a world like that because everybody needs help sometime. And so if you expect to get help, you have to be willing to give help. So there's not a contradiction in the very concept, but there's a contradiction in will, in that when you pass by without helping someone, you're helping to create a world where you're not going to be helped. And there's something irrational about that, where you're acting one way, but you expect other people to act towards you in another way. So we call that a contradiction in will. Objections to Kant. Well, one is he's too extreme, that he doesn't allow exceptions for the consequences when the consequences are really, really bad. He also says that you don't get moral credit when you're acting out of character. Out of character, not doing something wrong, acting out of character, but acting from a good character. So again, like the person who gives out of compassion or out of being sort of a nice, benevolent person, Kant says that person doesn't deserve moral credit unless they have this kind of rationalist idea that, oh, this is my moral duty, therefore I will do this. Seems kind of odd. So if Mother Teresa is only acting out of her compassion for suffering humanity, Kant would say, oh, well, she just kind of gets off on helping people. That would be Kant's view, that she just really loves helping people, but she's not really an especially good person. That's just kind of like her hobby, is going around helping poor people. And that's kind of a weird view. Kant seems to think that the only time you get moral credit is when you say, this is my duty, this is what I must do, this is the principle I have to follow. Instead of thinking, oh, there's a person that needs help, or gosh, I really should help these people. They look like they're down and out. I think I'll, do something for them. And Kant treats that as sort of the same as seeing somebody like, with a wallet sticking out of the back of their pocket, and say, oh, there's some money. I'd really like to have that money. And as if those are like two equivalent acts. And he's like, well, they're both desires, so they're the same. It's just one's a desire to help people, another is a desire to hurt people. And remember, the consequences don't matter. So it all comes back to the moral principle. So that's another objection, is just that Kant seems to think that people acting on compassionate desires, don't deserve any moral credit for their actions. Or people who act out of habit, out of a good character, don't deserve credit. When you look at Aristotle, for example, who will come to forthwith, Aristotle thinks that's what virtue is. That's what being a good person is acting out of habit without having to think about it. Kant says you can't lie to a murderer at your door. He comes in and wants to know where your family is. Suppose he wants to like kill your kids or your wife, and you have to say, "Oh, my kids and wife, they're in the back room watching TV." Right? You can't. And Kant says you can't even not answer the guy. If the guy asks you a straight question, you have to give him a straight answer. So you can't evade either, which, again, is kind of extreme to people. And also, Kant thinks that all rational people should agree on morality. And that also seems, you look at abortion or capital punishment or, the role of government.
you work in academia for a while, and you realize, like, there are people that seem completely rational that have such strange views about reality. You sort of, you give up, and you're like, well, you know, he doesn't seem like an idiot, but he believes all these false things, right? And he probably thinks I'm an idiot, right? And he's like, he seems completely rational, and then he's like, says this thing, and I'm like, that makes no sense to me at all. So it seems that people of goodwill and who are completely rational will can make mistakes about, or can just, let's say, can disagree about moral issues. And Kant doesn't allow for that. He thinks that if everyone's completely rational and their desires don't get in the way, they're all going to come to the same conclusion. And that's kind of a tough case to make, I think. Let's see. Virtue ethics. So what is virtue ethics? So virtue ethics says that the right act is the one which would be done by the ideal person out of habit. So so instead of trying to define what a right act is, it tries to define morality in terms of an ideal person. And so so you're not focusing on particular acts, but you're thinking like, what would be the best example? What's the best example of a human being, the sort of idealized version of a human being? Once you have that concept in your mind, you try to cultivate the characteristics of that person, the habits or dispositions of character of that person, virtues. And you try to emulate that ideal you have. Now, the ideal doesn't really exist, according to Aristotle. It's not like he thinks there's some ideal person out there. It's just you form an idealized conception of what a human being should be. And then, what is the right thing to do? Well, it's the thing that this sort of person would do. So it's different than act-oriented ethics, and it defines morality in terms of an ideally good person. It's a teleological theory in that it has to do with goal and purpose. And so Aristotle thinks human beings have a purpose, and so you have to figure out like what that purpose is, and then to the degree that you're fulfilling your purpose, you're a good person. Does Aristotle think that everything has a purpose? Yes, he does. he thinks that, you know, the purpose of, just like tools have purposes, like the purpose of a hammer is to pound nails, so things like the bacteria have purpose. The purpose of bacteria is to decompose. The purpose of the eye is to see. The purpose of the frog, I guess, is to eat flies and to hop around and feed whoever eats frogs. Anybody eat frogs? Alligators? People? French people? Yeah, people from Louisiana. There you go.
We need to know what eudaimonia is.
Eudaimonia. Yes. Let's get that over. We haven't quite gotten to that yet.
Okay. The short definition of
teleological. It means it's a theory based on goal or purpose. Goal, purpose, or function. So it's a theory based on goal, purpose, or function. And so Aristotle's theory is teleological in that you try to figure out, like, what is man's purpose? And how should... And then once you figure out what his purpose is, then you can have a standard for morality. So you figure out, like, what is it which would allow a man to serve his purpose well? And then you figure out what characteristics or tools, you know, he would need to do that, and that tells you what the qualities of a good person would be. So so what did Aristotle think man's purpose was? To be rational. So rational activity. So he says, human. What is man? Man is a rational animal. And so what distinguishes us from all other natural things is our capacity to reason. Therefore, you know, this question, I think I skipped over one. How do you figure out what a thing's purpose is? You see what it does, you see what it does best, and you see what it does which other things don't do. The things it does which are particular to it, which distinguishes it from all other things.
so man is distinguished from the animals in his capacity to reason. Aristotle also says, you know, reasoning is what man does best, and it's his characteristic activity. Therefore, the life which is most suited to man, and which is his highest purpose and calling, is the life of the mind, the life of the intellectual or the scholar. What are some problems with Aristotle's teleology? Again, why are teleological theories kind of questionable? And it's just that unless you believe in a designing mind like a god, the idea that natural things have purposes is kind of iffy. Think of an example. What's the purpose of a rock? Does everything really have a purpose? The rock, just to sit there. What if I'm really good at something, but I really don't like doing it? Yeah.
You said if people could put it better, where are they, like too in-depth, or...
Could you say that again?
You said if be like what? Like I'm just looking for a better word.
For
why like a rock? Like,
why a rock doesn't have a purpose?
Why would somebody saying like that rock has a purpose? Like is it too? Is it trying to read too much into it? Or?
Well, I think Aristotle thinks like everything. He has this idea of these. His teleological theory is like everything in the world has is like connected, and it all has a purpose and a function in the world. The purpose of the rock is just to sit there and be hard. It's easier with like a frog. What's the purpose of the frog? And the frog has a purpose like within an ecosystem, right? But it's kind of like if you say what is a frog for, it's kind of weird to say, well, a frog is there to eat the flies. Right. Now that's what the frog does, but it's like, does a frog really have a purpose? Now if you say like God made the frog to eat flies and to like serve a purpose in the ecosystem you designed, that's one thing. But if you believe in evolution, or like Aristotle has a sort of, he believes in God, but he doesn't really, God's not really a part of his system. So it's like if you don't put God in the picture, then you just have like things sort of evolved a certain way. And so the purpose thing doesn't really make that sense. So that's just that. Well, all you have to remember for the exam is that the notion that everything has a purpose is questionable, unless you assume that there's a God that designed everything, because you can't really have design without a designer. Is the argument. So let's see, where are we at here? Oh, what?
What is the ideal life?
Yeah, the ideal life is the life of the intellectual or the scholar, the philosopher. The philosopher who philosophizes with good looks, lots of money, and lots of friends. And so Aristotle thinks that the ideal life is the life of the intellectual, but to be an intellectual requires certain trappings. You have to have decent health, because nobody's going to want to be around you if you're always in your sick bed. A lot of the philosophizing would go on at the down at the gymnasium. Aristotle was famous for his peripatetic form of teaching, where he'd just like be walking around, but the students would follow him, and they'd be walking everywhere for exercise. So you need good looks and wealth and health and friends to have an ideal life, because those really need those to fully exercise your mind. If you're laying bricks or working like in a farm all day, that's stuff that's good, that's time that's going to come out of your philosophizing. That's not intellectual work. And so you're not going to have as good a life. Aristotle thinks that slaves and so on, and slaves and women aren't going to have ideal lives and not realize their minds as great as men will. So virtue is the mean between extremes. Which leads to success. So virtue is a quality which will help you fulfill your purpose as a rational animal to actualize your innate potentials. And it's always going to be some point between two extremes of too much and not enough. So moderation is the right amount of eating and drinking. You don't want to eat and drink too much, not too little. It's going to be someplace in the middle. And what's that?
Sorry.
You said what?
Moderation or temperance.
Means between
extremes. Two extremes. It's a mean between extremes. Too much and too little. Courage is, you know, fighting, and so it would be too much fighting would be like being a berserker, and too little would be a coward. And the mean isn't always in, right in the middle. Sometimes it's more towards one side or the other. In this case, more towards fighting than towards running away. And you figure out where the mean is, and how to act virtuously in particular circumstances through practice. So he says you learn courage through trying to perform courageous acts. You learn honesty through trying to be honest. You learn integrity from trying to have integrity. And so that's how you develop your character. So that actually answers the next two questions. How do virtues and Christian morality differ from Aristotle's theory? Faith replaces reason. Courage becomes like fighting the devil, and poverty becomes a virtue. And those are the main ones. There might be another difference. It's like poverty is a virtue. Oh, humility is a virtue according to Christianity. And what else are we missing here? Poverty, humility. Courage is like fighting the devil, and instead of reason, faith takes the top billing. Criticisms of virtue ethics. Well, is everything a mean between extremes? It seems like things like murder and theft don't obviously work with this idea of too much or too little. So certain things like why you shouldn't kill people and why you shouldn't steal stuff don't seem to fit the mean between extremes model. Other criticisms, though, the problem with the teleology, I suppose, is another one that we talked about earlier. I think that's the only criticism I'll have you remember. The teleology. So does everything have a purpose? Is questionable. Is what human beings really do best acting rationally? How does Aristotle prevent Athens from sinning twice against philosophy? He ran away when there was a coup, when there was a change in the government. What virtue or vice is relevant to the evaluation of Aristotle's behavior? Well, it's courage. So was Aristotle courageous or was he a coward when he ran away? Eudaimonia is success, human flourishing. So that's the goal of morality. Eudaimonia, success. Arete, best translated, virtue. It's a characteristic that leads you to have a successful life. And I have to blow through Nietzsche kind of fast here. So Nietzsche is similar to Aristotle's in that he's virtue ethics and he has a teleological view. So it's virtue ethics and teleology. By God is dead, he means faith in God is dead, that nobody believes in God anymore. The parable of the madman is meant to express this view of the death of God. And when the madman says, I've come too early, he means that nobody believes in God, but they don't understand the implications of that. So even though Europe has become skeptical, you know, the intellectuals in Europe have become skeptical of God's existence, they still haven't realized all the implications. And it's going to take them a while to do that. And God certainly isn't dead in the United States of America. Maybe in, like, you know, France or something. He's on his way out. But certainly there's many areas, including the U.S., where God is alive and well.
Are you going to finish the rest of this up on that?
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to finish this now. I'll go to like 3:30. If anybody needs to get out of here, you feel free to do so and pick it up on the recording. And thank you all for being here. Enjoyed having you in class. And good luck on the finals. I'm just going to keep on keeping on here. So evaluation took time out of her
class here, so let's see if we can finish up here.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Can you just quickly, what was the point of the madman? I kind of missed it.
So the parable of the madman is an illustration of the death of God, and the point is that nobody has faith in God anymore, but they don't realize the implications.
Okay.
Master and slave morality evolve from two classes of people, the rulers and the ruled. And each group developed its own value system. And so Nietzsche says that for the master, they needed certain characteristics like being ambitious and self-disciplined and smart and callous. That helps them maintain their power. For slave morality, you have to be docile and weak, otherwise you're going to get a beating, you might be killed. You have to sort of hang together so you believe in democracy and equality. If you get too smart for your own good, you might get in trouble, so it's good to be stupid. And living the terrible existence, you need a crutch, so you got to be religious. And that's his view of the slaves, have all these characteristics that helps them survive. Someone who is a good example of master morality would be a Viking. And Nietzsche's example of slave morality would be Jesus, who went around helping people and got himself crucified. I just talked about the virtues and vices of master and slave morality. Why does Nietzsche consider pity or compassion the primary slave virtue, and why is it bad? Well, when you show up pity or compassion on someone, you let them infect you with their weakness. You sympathize from them. If you have someone who's sad, all of a sudden, if you're happy as a clam, you're walking by, you see some sad sack laying in the street, and you think, oh, the poor man, how did he end up here? And all of a sudden, it's, the rest of your day is shot, and you're kind of feeling sorry for the guy, and then you're wasting your time helping him, and it all goes downhill from there. So compassion is, and pity is bad because it sucks the life out of you, so to speak. It makes you weak. What does he mean by the transvaluation of all values? And this is Nietzsche's idea of replacing Christian values with a set of values more in line with the science and Darwinian evolution. So he wants a kind of new set of values based on the survival of the fittest. So he just wants to turn morality on its head and have a new set of values for people that are more in line with the modern scientific knowledge. What does he mean when he says he's returned man to his place among the beasts? And that's just that man is an animal. He faults Plato for first introducing this idea that we're a combination of body and spirit, that the body is the prison house of the soul, and that we're really sort of these immortal souls trapped in a body, and our goal is to be free of our body and to float up to heaven. And he said this is a mistake, and man is just an animal. The Aristotle had it right. And so part of our having a good life is those animalistic desires and enjoying your life and having a life of happiness and pleasure and not believing in the fictions of God or the soul. The will to power is the life principle, which tries to grow, dominate, and prosper. So it's the principle of life, and what does life try to do? It tries to grow, dominate, and prosper. The overman is some future form of man that Nietzsche thinks will evolve, which will be so far in advance of us that we will look but like apes in comparison. Nietzsche thinks Christianity is, what does he think of it? Not too much. Let's see. He thinks it's a religion of slaves. It makes people soft and weak and docile and easily commanded, and it sort of makes humanity weak and is in the way of us advancing as a race.
Which God meant to be accurate?
Yeah, there you go. The race of dogmen, right. He says Christians are a race of dogmen, and sort of heard Rush today talking about the new castrati. he does this little thing where he talks in this lispy voice and with an imaginary person he's arguing with, and that's sort of, I can imagine Nietzsche using that phrase, a new castrati, to talk about Christians. So what do you think about the common man or average Joe or Jane? Not too much. Nietzsche thinks this idea of the nobility of the common man is a bunch of claptrap. Your average guy, he's not worth anything. You know, the guy that's emptying the waste baskets or pouring concrete or just like working at a desk job, he's nothing special. The people that really matter are like the great scientists and composers and artists and so on. Those people really matter. Your average Joe isn't worth very much, and you know, he's just a cog in the machine, and he can be easily replaced. But you can't replace somebody like a Wagner or an Einstein. What does he have to say about Kant? He says Kant's a closet theologian. That Kant pretends that his views come from reason, but really he's just like another believer in God, and he dresses up his views in fancy terminology, but he really is trying to get people to follow the golden rule. Democracy, Nietzsche is not a fan of democracy. You want to let like everybody have a vote? Even the common rabble, the peasants, you want them commanding the great and the powerful and the intelligent. Some objections to Nietzsche. Well, Nietzsche doesn't really refute Christianity. He just sort of assumes that it's false and then attacks it. he ignores our cooperative and collaborative natures. He thinks about human beings as being like a lone wolves, when really, you know, we kind of, part of human beings is they're social animals. We have this nature that helps that we cooperate and work together, and that's one of the reasons why we're so successful. And he has kind of a caricature of Christianity, I think, that might apply to certain kinds of Christians or interpretations of Christianity, but certainly not to all Christians. It seems that the United States embodies a lot of the virtues that Nietzsche thought were important. We're the most technologically advanced nation, we're the greatest economic powerhouse, we have the most achievement. If you look at the arts, if you look at science, if you look at industry, USA, USA, right? We're at the top of the heap. And we're a bunch of religious fanatics. Or, you know, compared to other countries, compared to Europe, the Europeans look at us as a bunch of religious wackos. And so it looks like, you know, religion and all the virtues that Nietzsche thinks are important can go together. All the founding fathers, you know, are, again, like a Benjamin Franklin, you know, very devout religious man, but also a great inventor, great political thinker, philosopher, and so on. The moral and political knowledge stuff should be fresh in your mind. Just because the fact that most people believe in objective morality is not proof that it exists, and even if it's beneficial to society, that doesn't mean it's legitimate. So both those, so just because everybody believes it doesn't mean it's true. Just because it would be really good if everybody believed it doesn't mean that it's true. So those are two really bad arguments for absolute morality. Hume's analysis is difficult because it lacks prescriptive force.
So put that phrase to be on the exam. Hume's analysis lacks prescriptive force. And what that means, lacks prescriptive force, is that it doesn't really tell you what to do. It just says, this is why you act like this. But it doesn't tell you whether you should do it or keep on doing it or not. Hume is merely describing how human beings act. He's not telling you what you should do. He's just saying what you do.
But emotion, feelings, not that.
Yeah, so he's just saying, you have all these feelings that make you do these sorts of things. But he doesn't say, well, should you go on with the feelings or not? And some arguments against moral skepticism and nihilism. Well, one is just this idea that morality is self-evident and that it's not something that really needs to be proved. And it's something that everyone believes in.
And even if you tried not to believe in it, you'd still end up believing it and acting on it anyway. So this is just this idea that morality is self-evident and unshakable. Could be two arguments against nihilism.
What's four?
Describe some of the attempts to answer the why be moral question. Arguments for moral skepticism or nihilism.
Right.
Oh, that's just what do moral statements refer to? So I have the cat is on the mat. I see the cat. I see the mat. The cat is on the mat. I can look and see. But if I say, meat is murder and you shouldn't eat animals, or if I say abortion is wrong, what can I point to? It seems like I can point to in the abortion clinic where the abortions happen. But then what do I point to show that it's wrong? Where's the wrongness I can point to? Is it sort of hovering like a cloud over the abortion clinic or something? I mean, how do I show that something's wrong? If I see, and so Hume makes this point that, it's really the feeling is in us. Because some people have positive feelings about abortion too. A woman's right to choose, right? And you get a positive feeling. And Hume says that there's no sort of right and wrong, it's just these irrational feelings we have. So to try to show no, that that's wrong, that there's some objective fact in the matter, is kind of a tough thing to do because it's hard to give proof of that. Yeah, so that's the problem, that's the argument for skepticism or nihilism. That there's no way to really prove morality. Describe attempts to answer the why be moral question. Oh, that's just one you could say, well, just because you should, and that it's self-evident. So that's one answer. And then the other thing you can do is just show that being moral pays. That most of the time, you're living where you are right now, that being a good person is going to pay off for you in the long run. On what do many modern ethicists base moral knowledge? And that's based on ethical intuitions. So modern ethicists base morality on intuitions. Intuitions. And intuitions form the data for morality. And so they use these hypothetical examples to try to hone our intuitions and try to isolate variables. And it sees them as just being like scientific experiments. So you imagine, like the last time I talked about, you imagine what if you could hook up to a machine that would give you only pleasure and nothing else. Well then, that shows you that if you think that would be bad, that shows that there's other things that are value in life other than pleasure. And so hedonism is false.
So it would be collective or the greater good?
Well, no, it would be the hypothetical examples in ethics help you understand these ethical intuitions and then come up with principles you can apply to other cases. Most philosophers believe ethics and political philosophy are they related? Most philosophers see political philosophy as a subset of ethics because there's always a moral component to a political judgment. So the two kinds of premises in moral political arguments, two kind of premises in political arguments. So in this second to last question, it says, what are two kinds of premises, which figure in political arguments? So the two kinds of premises which figure in political arguments, moral premises and empirical premises. This is just from the last lecture. Moral and empirical. So a moral premise would be everyone has a right to a living wage. That would be a moral premise. Minimum wage laws drive up unemployment. That would be an empirical premise. And that's it. So I'll stick around for any other questions you may have. Good luck on the exam. Feel free to send me a Moodle message, email, phone, only if absolutely necessary, and come by office hours or make an appointment if you can't make my office hours. And good luck on the final.
I'll have those extra essays done this weekend. I got a whole bunch of them, so I'm still in the midst of.
Yeah, 50 questions again.
Yeah, 50 questions.